November 5th.
Who's on the task, Shad task group?
Well,
everybody, please model your outfit so we can get this over.
Yeah, wait a minute. Why must I see this here?
Wow, oh. Betty Crocker's back in the back of the house.
Betty Crocker is here.
And that's stuffing up on the table.
Tammy Crocker. Tammy Crocker was a just cooker. Apparently, she's got a very good one for F-bomb, for the next F-bomb in town.
I hope for March. I hope for the pumpkin.
I think it's going to have to be December's F-bomb.
Miss Claus.
Very fancy.
I just can't wait till they legalize marijuana.
Then I'll have fun baking for you guys.
Baking will be a F-bomb will be a whole different meeting.
Like 2 days.
Best meeting ever. The brownies.
Brownies are good this time.
So, fearless leader.
Are you Mr. Shad?
You're looking at me?
Yeah. Is there anybody on the phone yet? Well, I'll just kind of start it off. At the last FPOM, we had so many issues with task forces, our task subgroups, that we weren't really prepared to talk about it, so we decided to have a special meeting, which is today. Thanks for everybody coming. We're talking about the shad fishery, the dals, then we're going to talk about the ties. Can we take them out and take them away or not? And then we're going to talk about the AFF. Dennis Schwartz apparently sent out an email, which I didn't see yet. I still haven't looked at my BlackBerry, with some data in it. Hopefully he's going to show up with copies of that.
That's what he says.
Okay.
I've talked to Langsley about this a couple times. Apparently he's got some analysis. He's got... At 10 o'clock...
It's in Word.
I brought it with me.
Yeah, okay, so somebody has a copy here. Way to go.
Oh, you have a copy.
At 10 o'clock, he's got Gene Plotsky calling in.
Yeah, exactly.
To talk, I guess, his...
At 10 o'clock?
At 10 o'clock.
Why?
How long is that going to take?
Ties is going to be pretty quick.
Ties is like 3 seconds.
All right. Well, let's make Shad 2 seconds. And
well, I haven't had a chance to read
five
through all
seconds.
This material.
and then,
I just needed to have Dennis do something.
Yeah, so we're slotted between 9 and 1. Hopefully we can shrink it up.
You have me till noon.
I have you till noon.
And then I'm gone.
And where are you going?
He's gone.
There's something called a 4 feet that need to get shot at.
Yeah.
And it's not you.
So. Yet.
Yeah. I might not be imagining.
I think you should be going up to Dorshak. Anyway, so that's the plan. Just let's go around the room so we know everybody here. Starting with Bob.
Bob Cordy, project biologist for the Dallas Dam.
Harry Frederick, Small Fisheries.
Tom Morse, Griffith.
David Wills, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Dave Bender, Fish Pass Center.
Roger Digg, Jr., Yakima Nation Fisheries.
Thanks for coming,
John
Roger.
And Stuart Ellis with Griffith, I do harvest management.
And Scott Bethel, BPA.
Tammy. Assistant
Tammy Crocker and Bernard Klett with the Corps, Portland District. So, you are in charge of the task group.
All right. Okay. So, you guys got three attachments.
We got all kinds of stuff. One of them didn't work. I don't know what happened there, but the guidelines, 10, came out like that. Several times for me, and I don't know.
No, it doesn't normally work like that.
Yeah, well, I got a brief glimpse of it, and then all of a sudden I went.
Okay.
I don't know if other
people
have that
problem. Anybody else have copies
of that one? Which one
of you copies of that? I just
probably provided to NIMS now.
Yeah, that's hard.
copies of which are you talking about?
Are the guidelines?
Guidelines.
Yeah. I got
them. Yeah, I'll photograph
them. Okay. At least we have
eight. Who just joined?
Gene
Plotsky. Hey, Gene. Thanks for calling in. We're talking about the Shad task group first, then we'll talk about ties, so stay tuned.
Okay. So we've got several spreadsheets here.
I just want to run through the data real quick.
Okay.
We got a little history first.
Yeah, we had... you want some history on...
Yeah.
Okay.
So everybody's up to speed.
It's been around for a while. When did the Shad fishery started?
95.
95, yeah, about that.
I was reading through the early history of it. I've got it all here.
It's been off and on since then, mostly dependent on the market. And they don't really know what the market's going to do until the last minute, whether or not they're going to fish. The concern came up about fallback. We started looking at fallback at the count station for salmonids immediately downstream of the exit, and we started seeing it with the Chinook, primarily Chinook. We looked at sockeye and steelhead. There was a little bit on sockeye one year, but
I've joined the conference.
Barely enough to notice, and the other
David Clexton
has joined the conference.
So we focused on Chinook, and the data sets that I have are from 07, 08, and there was no fishing in 09, and this last year, 2010. 2010, we did a little more analysis on looking at the whole month of May just to see what the average fallback for Chinook was through the whole month of May, and that was one of the attachments. And we just basically came up with a monthly average of fallback, which was around 2.4%. And we summed up all the hours of counting through the month of May.
For non-fishing.
For non-fishing, yeah. And so we still have, there's 2 weeks, and then the fishery started mid-June. Well, actually, June 11th and 12th were the only 2 days that the fishery actually occurred. And we didn't crunch the numbers from June 1 to 10. We can do that if needed. But basically what we're looking at is about 2.4% fallback on average for the month of May. And most of that fallback, if you look at it, occurred the first hour of counting and the last hour of counting. So if you take those out of 31 hours through the whole month where it exceeded 10%, 21 of those landed either the first hour or the last hour counting. So that seems to be a sign that the fallback accelerates a little bit. So looking at that and then comparing it to what we saw at the fishery, it's pretty apparent that the fishery is creating some fallback. At this point, we kind of run out of ideas. We tried the L-shaped design last year. I didn't actually see it, but I don't know, Roger, did you get a chance to see the actual L-shape?
I didn't actually get out and look at it.
Okay, because the fishery occurred on it 2 days that I wasn't there. So the L-shape, the thought was, in 08 when we were looking at it, there was one day that there wasn't any dipping, but they still had a containment net out in front of the exit, just a square containment net. But apparently it wasn't, for some reason, the shad weren't getting in there enough for them to dip, so they were basically just hanging out in the boat waiting for the shad to accumulate. And that day, if you look at the data, it looked pretty clean. There wasn't much fallback. But the other days, when there was some dipping right there in front of the exit, there was fallback. And so we figured, okay, it's got to be the dipping. It's not the containment net. So we figured if we put an L-shaped design, get the dipping away from the exit, that might do it. And apparently didn't.
Was that the design, or did the fishers follow that advice?
From what I understand, they did. They put in the L-shape.
They put in
but
the
like
L-shape
I said, I didn't see
follow
it.
That.
I don't know. And I don't know how far away the dipping actually occurred. I don't know if that's...
Yeah, I didn't.
So,
didn't
actually,
yeah. Okay. When do they install the L-shape or the net, whatever it is, the device in front?
It was installed the day of fishing.
So it can go in and out daily? It's attachable and detachable readily?
Not readily.
Okay.
No.
If you're looking for other ideas, what I was thinking possible might be is that you put a kind of a purse seine or a net out there, you just close it off and take it away and then get the fish out that way. You don't actually dip net in there. You just take
it
all
to another location. Yeah.
Yeah, and then just haul them out. And yeah. Then every day, if you can put it on when it's dark, before the fish start passing, take it out when you got some there and just do it once a day, attach and take it away.
Yeah, that's a possible alternative too.
Except for bycatch, salmon, and that.
Well, they'll still be alive. I mean, it's not, you know, you should be able to sort them. You're not killing them. You're just purseing them.
You get frills on that and all that. You really don't want to raise that argument right now?
Mm-hmm.
Washington test fishery? I'll ask you about that later.
It's a possibility, but the containment net, I don't know if they really have enough shad in there at one time to go through all the trouble of hauling it somewhere and then dipping them out. They probably have to do that hundreds of times to fill a tote. I don't know.
So the issue here is fallback.
But the issue is the fallback. It's there. It's apparent. Everything we've tried to date has not worked.
But I guess
we're out of ideas.
Yeah, I'm wondering, Roger, what are you guys thinking? What's the Yakima's recommendation here or thoughts on this? Are you guys intending to continue to try to do this, or are you going to go back and say this is probably not working out?
Right. That's a good question. I haven't actually had a chance to talk with my policy folks on this yet. I know we do have an issue with the fallback, like you were saying. The way this thing is gone, there's one thing I'm curious about. It seemed like when the fishery first started back in the mid-90s that things went well, and I don't know if there was the same fallback issue like there is now, so I don't know if they were doing the same window counts and all that kind of stuff. But
I don't think we were looking at it as close.
Anyways, the fishery seemed like it was doing okay when it started. You know, they were getting a lot of shad. There wasn't a lot of fall.
There was like a half a million fish.
Yeah.
One year.
Yeah.
It was really high.
And then, like Bob said, the market went away, so the fishing stopped for a number of years. And then we just recently restarted it a few years ago. And we kind of have different people doing it now, you know, different fishers setting up the net, constructing the net, doing that kind of stuff. And this fallback has been an issue. Just personally, I'm kind of torn a little bit because, you know, we have the fallback issue that we know is not good. You know, we're not intending to, you know, impede the salmon stocks that are coming up. You know, we don't want to do that. But on the other hand, you know, a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. You know, there's no shortage of ideas on catching shad. You know, everybody's all got all these kinds of different ideas, you know, from trap nets and seines and all this kind of stuff. But nobody, you know, has the money or resources or funding or all that kind of stuff to try any of these other things. So we've just kind of held on to this fishery, even though we know it's not working real well. Like Bob has said, and how his the data shows, as soon as they start fishing, we start running into issues with fallback, and we've been closing down the fishery fairly soon. It's bad in the sense that it closes real fast, but it's good in the sense that while they are fishing, the tribal fishers are getting some income and catching some of these fish and making some use of it.
Does this affect the buyer? I mean, if it's inconsistent and they don't know when the end date might hit, it could be 2 days or 10 days.
Well, the market, there seems to be a big shad market now for some reason, I don't know. And there's multiple buyers.
So they're willing to risk.
Even when we've had to shut down, there's been other buyers that wanted to come in and get some fish that were not able to.
All right, so that shouldn't be a problem.
Yeah, that wasn't. And that's what I'm thinking is, I need to talk to my policy folks to see if they want to keep trying to hang on to this fishery even though it's not working very well, or if they want to say, okay, let's quit doing that and let's focus our energy somewhere else. You know, something else. You know, farther away from the dams. You know, type of trap.
Yeah.
Saying, you know,
there are lots of ideas out there that are bouncing around. If, you know, we've had ideas for 20 years on how we might get more shad out of different areas, including at Bonneville Dam. And we'd hoped that we could get something in the Accords a few years ago that would specifically earmark money for that, but it didn't happen, unfortunately. I don't know if there's a way to, I know we don't reopen that discussion, but you know, if there's some way to channel some money into this, it would be, I think, advantageous to all of us. I think there's a good reason to remove as many shad as we possibly can out of the system. So,
I have one question. You know, I'm not an FPOM member, so I'm not sure. Is this like TAC, where you know the object here is to kind of reach technical consensus?
Yeah, it's technical consensus committee that come up with recommendations.
So the agenda item says proposal to cease shad fishery. But that's not, you know, technical folks don't make, that's a policy decision, right? And so what we would do is we'd reach technical consensus on something and then we would recommend to our policy folks. Is that how it works, or?
Yeah, if we agree here, that generally doesn't go much higher, or any higher. So it's this is the first screening, and you know we can make agreements here if everybody agrees. That's it.
Are we supposed to take it back to the full FPOM?
Oh, full FPOM. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
That's
We're a subset.
This
just
is
a subset of FPOM.
Well, for the tribal staff, there isn't any way that any of the tribal CryptFed staff here can make a decision to either have or not have a fishery. That has to be done by our policy people. So the technical staff on FPOM or on any other technical group could make a recommendation that a fishery either is or is not appropriate, but the actual decision as to whether or not to implement a fishery or even propose a fishery come from that policy.
Yeah, it still doesn't change. I mean, if you can come here and tell us you don't want fishery, then we're done.
It's
up to individuals to have that say, and if you have a say, then you can say it here, and if everybody agrees, that's the end of the story. But if you can't make that decision or don't want to, then it goes up to the next level, absolutely.
Yeah. Are we deciding on a fishery or are we deciding on a location?
It's a location.
This is just the DALs. Right. We're just talking about the DALs here. You know, really, whether this is a good thing to be doing at the DALs or not. If not, then, you know, how can we do it better? And that would raise it to another. And that probably goes back to harvest folks more than it does here.
So one question that's going to naturally come up amongst the tribal policy people when they're trying to make a call as to whether or not they want to implement a shad fishery in 2011 at the DALs Dam would be, you know, looking at these data on the downstream passage through the fish ladder, is they're going to ask, well, what's the mortality associated with that? How many fish are we killing? And if we're you know faced with a situation where we can't really say what the mortality is, then they're going to be left kind of puzzled as to, well, you know, is this fallback a significant enough problem for the salmonids that it outweighs the benefits of catching the shad? And that's going to have to be the decision that they're going to make in whether or not to go forward with a fishery plan, you know, to propose a fishery. And certainly if it were possible to assign some mortality and say that, you know, because of this shad, you know, if you fish for shad for, you know, 6 hours a day for, you know, a week, you know, if it were possible to say you're going to kill 43 salmon, then they might say fine. And we would simply count those 43 salmon as part of the overall tribal impacts. That the way the biological opinion for the fisheries is structured is that any mortality caused by shad fishing at the Dallas Dam on salmonids just comes out of the overall tribal fishery impacts. So if it were if it were possible to say, you know, from these data that, you know, this year when they went shad fishing for 2 days, and looks like 135 salmon went down through the fish ladder, if that killed two of them, then we add two onto the catch. Call it good. And if it didn't kill any of them, then we add zero on. I think the tribes would be interested in working towards some sort of being able to assess, you know, what the actual mortality associated with this is. If these 2 days of fishing, if these 135 fish that went downstream through the ladder, if they just went down and then the next day came back up again, and everything's hunky-dory, then I think the tribes might not view that fallback as a huge issue and might choose to continue with shad fishing. They may just decide, though, that they don't like to see all these fish moving down through the fish ladder, and they might well call it off and go look for other opportunities to catch shad. But being able to inform them as to, I think these sorts of measurements that you provided here with the numbers of fish passing down stream through the fish ladder is good. It would be better if we had, you know, like pintail arrays where you could, you know, make assessments of how long it took those fish to turn around and go back upstream again, or whether they ever came back upstream again. That would be a really interesting piece of data if you could do that. But unfortunately, you know, with the way these are, you can't tell whether, you know, these are just simply on the next day's counts going up back up again. So anyway, that's all I had on that.
Stuart, if we were to follow that line of reasoning, which makes sense to me, and I mean, I understand what the policy people need to talk about, wouldn't we also need to estimate or discern in some manner the breakout of the number of fallback fish that are, you know, if there is mortality,
mm-hmm.
what percentage of those fish would be hatchery versus wild to count against the quotas?
Yeah, well, it would be useful during the say like sockeye. The way we're doing sockeye is we're actually reconstructing the Snake River portion of the run, and assuming that like listed Snake River impacts occur throughout the sockeye fisheries at the same rate we're catching sockeye over the whole run. So if we catch 7% of the sockeye run, we presume that we've caught 7% of the listed Snake River fish.
So you're suggesting to apportion whatever count of sockeye go through that day of shad fishery, you subtract 7% from mortality?
Well, no, not 7%. So no, in a high abundant sockeye year, the tribal fishery is allowed to catch 7% of the sockeye run.
Okay.
And we assume that what that means is we've also caught 7% of the snake river fish that were
okay.
swimming within that. So it assumes the sockeye fishing occurs fairly evenly throughout the whole run. And so if the result of shad fishing at the Dallas Dam if it were to kill 100 sockeye, we would assume that 7 of them would have been listed snake river fish.
Okay. Yeah, just some manner of apportioning.
Yeah, and so we would do that sort of stuff. And same with Chinook. So this shad fishing went on this year, the 11th and 12th, that's still in the spring management period. And so associated with that, if we were able to estimate some number of Chinook mortalities in that, we would incorporate that into the overall spring catch and apportion that into relative portions of listed Snake River
okay.
and Upper Columbia
gotcha.
Wild fish that would be in there.
Okay.
And, so.
With the information we have, I don't know how we could possibly get a mortality number out of it.
There would
that's kind of the...
It would have to be,
There's more to it than mortality. There's take.
Yeah.
And take is defined not mortality, but as harm, harass, as well, so...
Well, the take in fisheries is mortality. That's how the take
not under ESA. Under ESA, it's not.
But they must have coverage here.
Well, they have coverage. Yeah. We're certainly looking at that right now. There's a lot of concern over that coverage. That's pretty weak. So I think it's a slippery slope when you go down that way. You know, that's basically saying to a lot of folks that delay and harassment at these projects is minimal if you can't prove mortality immediately, because that's how you're going to be able to prove. Then what's wrong with all of the things that people want to do at these projects that could cause delay or mortality that's well within what's in the biological opinion, then who cares? I'm not sure we really want to start that trend. So I would urge the Yakimas to take a hard look at where we go with this, you know, and saying something, you know, to the effect that it's not, that it's allowable, you know, because everybody has a buy-up. Otherwise, they're not able to do anything on the river. But I'm a little worried about the precedent we set and the bar that we set for harm here.
Right.
I'll carry that back to our folks.
I know Stuart brings up a good point here with the documenting the mortality part of it. I think the way we look at it back at Yakima is, we've had these same basic rules for a lot of years, and we've agreed to the 10% fallback criteria for a lot of years. So we're not going to change that. You know, we're not going to come in and say, oh, that needs to be 20% or 30% or something to allow us to fish or something. I don't think we're going to do that. It is a really interesting question on how many of those, how many fish actually die. If they just hang out in the ladders a little bit longer and then go back up. But I don't think we're going to get into all of that. To answer the question whether we'll keep pursuing this fishery or not, to be honest with you, I think we will. There's a lot of pressure. There's a good market. We have multiple buyers, California and Asia and different places that want these fish. One of the ways we've been looking at this is we have these guidelines, and even though the fishery hasn't been successful, we feel like the guidelines are working the way they were intended to. If we exceed the criteria, we follow the guidelines and we close the fishery. And that's why we've only fished, a couple of days, 3 days, whatever. What I need to do is I need to talk to my policy folks and tell them, they're probably not going to want to abandon trying this fishery. And there's a few reasons for that. The biggest one is there's going to be a lot of requests from the fishers to do it. But it doesn't work well for the fishers if they tell a buyer, we can get you so many poundage, and then they come in and they only fish a day or two, two or three days or whatever it takes to close. They can't get the poundage for them. So, we're not, that's not what we want. The other thing I think that the reason why we're not going to give up on this fishery is things seem like they've been a little weird the past few years. The weather's been weird. The flows have been weird. I think this year there was a lot of water. There's been high winds. There's been different things like that where I think our guys, our main guy who sets up the net, I think he still believes there are tweaks and changes and things that he can do to try to help this fallback issue. We tried the L-shaped net, and I think, that was an initial effort at it, but we only tried it for a couple of days. I know the guy still thinks that there's some things he can explore to try to help that. I don't know. But I think from our side of it, we look at it like the guidelines are working like they're supposed to, and we're probably not going to want to give up on this fishery, but
we'll stick to the guidelines that we've always agreed to. And then what I need to tell my policy folks is if we go in and fish a couple of days and then have to close this fishery, you know, we really need to put a lot of effort into finding different ways to catch shad where we're not affecting salmon passage, so we can stabilize the fisheries, you know, better serve these markets and do that kind of stuff.
I'd love to work with you guys on that.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's some good ideas.
And that, there is a lot of interest in trying some alternative gear and alternative locations. So the idea of doing a purse seine fishery for shad using an Alaskan herring net, and the idea of trying to build a trap in some other
right.
place on the river,
right.
you know, outside the BRZ. I think there's, I think if we could figure out a way to access a bunch of shad and never be in the BRZ again, I think our fishermen would be immensely happy.
Fish wheels.
Right.
All those kind of things. I mean, but the problem has been is coming up with the money to test the gear. So there's actually the guy who built the Colas purse seine boat has expressed some interest in it. But the problem is he can't afford to absorb the risk of getting a boat geared up and bringing it up to Zone 6 and testing in an area where there's really no guarantee that anybody's going to make any money and how that's going to work. And the tribes have not been able to come up with, you know, grants or other sources of funding to just pay the cost of doing the test. And so we keep running up against this thing, yeah, we could put something together, but...
How much?
But how... I think, you know, boat and crew time is, it's going to be in the, you know, getting the gear together. I would think you could actually probably do it for not much money. I think, you know, a whole test and being able to, you know,
depends
write
on
a report on what you catch, like $10,000 or something, you could do it. I mean, kind of chump change for what people spend on the Columbia River doing research.
Right.
And,
right. You guys ever ask the buyer if they'll support that?
The buyers are kind of greedheads.
I mean, you don't have to have a viable fishery if you can't raise your price of your shad, saying, yeah, I'll get you something. It's going to cost you twice as much you're getting now. So that would stay.
You know, buyers should be investing.
Yeah, the buyers always come and they always say, you want to buy 10 million pounds of shad at half a cent a pound.
Yeah,
so thanks.
That's where they start.
And then if you start saying, well, no, I want 80 cents a pound, then it's like, oh, we're not all that interested. So, but anyway, that's kind of been the struggle, is just to come up with... And then we've actually had a little bit of struggle just even making sure that the fishermen are available, because, you know, we've had fairly good summer fishing opportunities and people have been anxious to get out right at the start of the summer management period on June 16th. And so the fishermen are kind of laying the odds, do I want to experiment with trying some new ways to catch shad when I can do a sure thing and go out and catch some summer chinook and make some money? And then it leaves us in this little window in the first couple of weeks of June when people aren't typically doing anything and trying to, you know, get that in there. We just haven't been able to get it all figured out yet. But we do want to. So.
On trying to develop another way to catch shad, I think we're caught in a conundrum here a little bit. You know, for the tribal governments, it's better for us if we just regulate things and you know, say what they're allowed to do and what they're not allowed to do. But it's better for the fishermen to really drive, you know, what they want to do, you know, how they want to catch them. But, you know, they don't want to spend a lot of money and invest in a different gear type if it's not going to work. And so... you know, it gets into this weird thing. You know, we don't know what to authorize because it hasn't been tested yet. They don't know what to really try.
Because nobody knows if you make money out of it.
Right, right. And
So it's it gets difficult that way. So I, you know, I'm not sure what we can do on that end. I don't know. We don't have anybody from the States here, do we? From Washington?
No.
Is nobody on the States on that point?
Yeah,
they're part of a bigger group.
It's a bigger group, okay, but they're not here today.
Yeah, Oregon rep isn't here. Oregon's representative in Idaho sometimes.
Oh, okay.
Washington rarely.
Oh.
Well, never.
Because I was, they have a chat history in the whole river.
Yeah, I, okay.
But I don't know. It doesn't seem like they have good summer. I think they just use
fish counting.
It's only fish
counting.
They fish a little off the main channel, and they're really strong. I haven't had much salmon try catch.
Yeah.
Sometimes
chat
fisheries
are
okay, a lot of times it's
not possible. So is the FPOM recommendation going to be that we don't do this fishery anymore?
Well, just so you know, the purpose of this was to discuss the fishery, not to say that we don't support your fishery or we're trying to seize it. I think that was the way it was framed on the agenda.
It's an ongoing.
It's basically, we have the guidelines in place, and we want to know what the tribe's intent is for the future. We know there's delayed. There's delay in the ladder, possible, I mean, harassment, whatever you want to call it, direct mortality. I don't know how much direct mortality we have in there, but it's basically what is the plan forward so we can plan for that. Can we modify this? We have our guidelines in place. Maybe there's alternatives to fishing for shad elsewhere, but it's basically come together, talk about what the next step is. It sounds like you need to talk to your policy folks, but you're leaning towards you want to continue doing the fishery in John Day or the Dalles ladder, and you're willing to continue using the guidelines is what I'm hearing for right now, and possibly looking elsewhere if you can come up with a better fishery.
Right. Last year, looking specifically at last year, how many days of fishing occurred? Two days?
Two days.
Just a few days.
And every
two days
day,
and then it was shut down.
Every day it exceeded.
Because we hit the criteria, so.
So that's kind of a
red flag.
Yeah, I mean, what are we going to change that would change that? That's the question. Our main concern is that ladder passes the majority of the fish at the Dalles Dam and the Columbia Basin above the Dalles Dam. It passes about all the sockeye. We have very few sockeye going through the North Shore, so that's the real concern. Is that we have a, you know, we do everything we can to speed these fish up the river, and in this situation, we're actually causing some problems for them. If we could resolve that, I mean, we do have the study that was done by University of Idaho back in 98, I think it was. No, it was earlier than that, 96, that showed no impact, you know. So at least there was a point where we were having very little impact, but now we're seeing quite a bit of impact. So I agree, there's something. Something seems a little odd here, you know, what's going on.
Is it that net?
Yeah. You know, or is it something that, you know, some part of our practices that have changed enough that we're causing scent, you know, smell in the ladder that we can avoid somehow? I don't know. So that's. And I'm kind of reluctant to just let guys try whatever they want. You know, that concerns me because we'll have, we need to at least keep an eye on what we've done in the past to learn from that.
I thought U of I had a second look and they saw something.
Oh, this is just the 1 year. I grabbed this. This happened to be in my file. There may be other years.
That,
yeah, and then the, you know, the harm issue too, and I'll go back and talk to our harvest folks about that, but you know, that it is harm. It isn't just mortality. The buyout or the Endangered Species Act is clear on what take is, and consultation has to include all forms of take, so I don't know how they allowed for, you know, the latent effects of delay and timing and all that, but there probably isn't a huge effect. You know, it's just the situation of the example is not the best example in the world to have out there when there are other folks who want to do things to cause delay as well. And there's a cumulative effect, but I don't know if anybody's calculating cumulative effects of all these different things, but is difficult, and the onus to calculate that effect is really on the fishers, you know, the folks that are asking to do this.
So, what would help me in going through all the information Bob provided? It was kind of difficult because I didn't have a lot of time. It was kind of difficult to boil down. I couldn't even tell for sure how many days of fishing there were.
Yeah, no, I was having trouble with that.
Yeah. Figure out what all the information meant. A summary.
Clean it up and summarize.
Would be really helpful.
We'll do that.
On exactly what happened these past few years. And,
yeah, the key is what exactly the
what
fish,
happens.
What were they doing?
Because that's our task, is to provide an assessment of the operational impacts. What it means depends on ESA.
Yeah.
Whether it's done or not depends on policy decisions. But we need to provide an accurate description of what happened.
The clear thing from this meeting is that the Yakimas want to continue doing it. That, you know, there's some concern over what we've seen in the past. So it doesn't make a lot of sense to me to continue a fishery that you get 2 days and get shut down on. So what we need to do is figure out how, or if there's a way forward that makes, you know, the fishery possible and so it minimizes the impacts. And then if that doesn't work, then is there another method that we can come up with to remove shad from the system? Because that everybody, I think everybody has that goal in mind. That, you know, that you guys can do, that's great. It's just, how do we do it without impacting salmon passage? And I think that's everybody's goal as well. It's just a matter of how we do it.
There was one question. Our main guy that works on the shad fishery has been wondering about the spill wall and about you know, whether a lot more fish were using the, you guys call it the north ladder?
North ladder, yeah, versus
Washington
the east.
Side. And then, you know, there was that one spill wall that was built.
Right.
I guess it was
short.
Yeah. And so now it's been moved a little farther out. But it seems like most all the fish were coming to the Oregon side.
Yeah, I looked at that pretty carefully, Roger, and we were seeing, what we saw before the wall went in was about 10% of the Chinook actually used the north ladder. This past year, it was closer to 20 to 30%, so we actually improved that north passage for Chinook. Mm-hmm. But even before the wall and after the wall, smaller fish like Jack Chinook and Sockeye used the east ladder about 90 or more percent of the time, 95% of the time. So we didn't help passage for small fish, but we did for large fish. They, because of the depth differences there, I think, is part of it. Those fish are able to find seams and get on up there to that north ladder. So we saw a doubling or more, you know, maybe a tripling of usage of that ladder. And that's just based on the window counts. That's not based on radio tracking. We'll see that data yet probably in a couple of weeks at the AFEP review. We'll see the review from University of Idaho and what they saw. But from what Chris Caudill told me, their data are comparing well with what I reported in window counts.
So, Gary, does that reduce the impact of the shad fishery because a greater percent are going the other way, so your 10% may not actually be occurring?
Oh, no.
Is 10%, your 10% only in the
ladder? Of that ladder.
It's only the east ladder, but the impact to the entire run, yeah. I mean, there's more fish using a different ladder. That's good.
I didn't know if the criteria was one ladder or if it's a combined.
It's just a ladder.
We had a little discussion this morning before I came over here with our policy folks, and the point I made that I'm concerned about is sockeye. You know, that's the time of year when sockeye are passing. They're not using the north ladder. You know, that was pretty apparent from the window counts. So. Now they're moving over to the other side. I don't know the fallback with sockeye. I don't know how, if we saw a problem with them falling back, you know, then maybe it's not an issue.
We weren't seeing it when we looked at it, but we kind of stopped looking at it because it wasn't showing up. We just focused on Chinook.
We should look at all species. Yeah, we should look at all species of fallback. But, you know, if it's not an issue, not an issue.
And I guess that kind of brings the question. So the path forward I see is Roger's going to go back, talk to fisheries,
if anyone has ideas or tweaks that we think we can make for the fisheries, because we only have tested this new system for 1 year, and I think there was some talk that they're not sure if they got the net set as well as they could have. So they're thinking they can maybe do a better job with that. So I guess the question we've got is if we could go out, hopefully get the net set properly, get another test of it this year, and we'll just obviously follow the guidelines we've set, we can move forward with that. Hopefully we'll get some funds to do some other testing and that kind of stuff.
I see three things here, and I agree. If you guys, we have the guidelines, so follow the guidelines, but try it again next year, see what happens. It would be good maybe to have another meeting of this group before the fishery, just to talk about the methods that, the changes that the fishers intend to employ. That would be, I think, worthwhile. And in the meantime, Dave's request of getting a better review of the methods today would be, I think, really good to have in hand for folks to take to that meeting. And maybe the meeting would be in March or, something like that. Once the fishers have a chance to think about modifications. And then in the meantime, it'd be nice to think about other ways of, of doing this fishery away from, or even in, I'd like to see it in lieu of the Dalles, but, anything else would be, I think, a benefit. And I don't know if we keep talking regionally about doing shad research, and I think it keeps getting to the bottom of the heap, but I don't know, is Bonneville doing anything? Are you guys funding anything for research?
I don't think we are.
Somebody was funding something because it pit tagged some shad for some reason.
There was that.
Pit tagged shad.
That's interesting.
Around,
but that was in it.
Hey, Gary, this is Chris Cuddle.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of lurking back here, kind of.
Aha.
We've been doing some shad stuff on and off, and we're finally sitting down to write some of this stuff up. And I worked with the Cook Lab and Ted Castro Santos from the Conti Lab out on the East Coast this last summer, and we were able to radio tag a couple hundred shad. So we'll have a little better sense of what shad are doing in the system.
They swim around.
Beyond just the pit tag data we've been collecting, we've got about 3 years of decent pit tag data.
Okay.
Hopefully all that stuff's going to be coming out over the next year or so.
Well, that'll be a help. I guess what I was...
None of it's funded, so we've just been kind of piggybacking it.
Okay.
So, at some point I completely agree that it would be really nice to be able to look at some of this stuff systematically.
Did you say you've done some radio tagging, or you're going to?
They have.
We did last year. We had some leftover tags that the Corps was gracious enough to provide us.
You're going to have some reports about where you saw those fish?
Yeah.
Because that actually might be helpful.
We tagged fish at Bonneville and the AFF, and we also... angled a few and electroshocked a few down below the tail race.
Because that would be good information if you find it if they congregate somewhere.
We tracked them all the way up to John Day, I think.
Yeah, because if the radio tagging data shows any place where they're spending time where a fisherman might go and
especially doing this.
We'd like to know that.
We probably won't have that kind of resolution because, well, unless it happens to be in a tail race, but where a first thing isn't going to work. So we probably won't have data at that resolution. Piggybacked our array at the dam.
Okay, my thinking was a little different. What I'm trying to come up with is a smoking gun approach that would drive more money towards
shad.
I think actually Matt Mesa's work on overwintering population of predators in the John Day Pool could shed some light on their usage of juvenile shad, which would come out in the millions every year about this time. That might get people to think a little more about funding some ways of removing or at least coming up with better methods.
So Gary,
implementation may be up to the fishers, but
does NOAA have any grants in their pipeline?
What we're working on is marine mammals. That's our big concern right now. So that's all of our money's kind of going towards that.
Right, but somewhere in the fisheries, part of NOAA Fisheries, I bet you there's grants that go towards improving a fish collection method.
That's something I'd work on, but certainly worth, folks should try to pursue that if it's out there.
I bet you there are grants for that.
I don't know. Gear development, that's a harvest side of it.
Roger, did you guys ever look at John Day Forbay? Remember there was one time we had that tough boom up there that has a, that had a 4-foot skirt on it, and there was an opening against the powerhouse, and it went up to the shoreline, and there were thousands of shad that would not go under that boom, right up against the rocks. You could have stood on rocks and got all you wanted. I think that has some major potential.
The new
because
BGS
that's
for shad.
Because
what,
they
what do you do with that old BGS?
Yeah.
We have one actually.
We got a bottle of BGS.
I think it's sold already.
Yeah. Oh crap!
But
really, where'd it go?
I mean, that has potential.
Yeah, I think. We did have a couple of our guys go up and look at it, and I think the biggest thing they wondered about was how we would get the fish out.
But you got him in the tow or something like that.
Yeah.
I mean a crane or something like that, right?
Cool. Oh boy, I think that would be easy to work out.
Yeah, if that that's, we should there. We should work on
but
that.
But the problem is we don't have that tough boom there anymore. That's been removed.
Have to come up with an
so
idea.
So we'd have to, but something similar to use that same principle.
Shut
does it work? Because they school big time up in John Day
and
Forbay.
And you just put a fish wheel in right there, and we have a facility, a lifting facility, and a truck sitting there on the bank. Hey, I could.
Yeah.
Just a little money.
Of course, this is a little money.
All right, well, it's almost 10 o'clock, so it sounds like we're kind of wrapping this up.
Path forward.
Plan forward is to. Roger's going to talk with his policy people and come out with a policy position. We're going to get a some kind
better
of a write-up and analysis of what we have. Hopefully we'll get some reports from Chris and Matt or maybe some preliminary data for the March meeting, and we'll take it from there.
Okay.
Appreciate you coming all the way down for this meeting, and I think that's it, unless anybody else has anything to add.
That's good. We want to see what Dennis's homework looks like here. So,
Next is going to be the ties analysis. We've had the ties around for quite a while. There's six remaining.
Yes.
They are all sitting in the on the deck now. Are they all out?
Yeah, they're all out. Gene's in
the
phone.
Yeah, he's already on
the phone. Gene,
you on?
Or he was. Excellent. Okay, we're going to get started here in just a minute.
Okay, who else is on the phone? I heard Clugger, you're on there? Yeah.
Wait, yeah, me. I'm going to come over for the AFF part.
Okay.
Keep track of what's going on.
All right.
Yep.
Come on over, and then who else is on the phone besides Chris? Are you, Chris, you're probably going
to
duck off now, or?
What time do you think you'll get to the AFF part?
Oh, probably in a half hour. If,
half hour?
They're
saying an hour.
Half hour to an hour. So.
David Clarkson.
All right. So you guys just hang tight. We're going to go through this ties evaluation discussion, and then we'll get to the AFF. This table's so big, man.
And has everyone signed in?
Signed in.
Oh, you
check
it. Did you give that to me?
You can take them out. Thanks. Done.
All right. So.
Yeah, thanks, Dennis, for
that.
What happened to my handout here?
Wait a minute, I haven't read it yet. Didn't get a handout.
All right, so,
what do you got here?
Here we are. So what the Byrne and Ops has asked for is kind of twofold. One is to, let's take a snapshot look at what we've done here in the last 3 years, what information we have, and then a little bit of historical data. So this package is compiled with Gene Plosky so graciously helped pull this stuff together in the front of the package about what we've seen recently at the powerhouse since the BGS has been in. This is no ties in several years, ties out a couple years. And then the back of the packet is a lot of the old historical information about FGE work, why we put ties in, what some of the preliminary findings were back between out years. And where I pulled that data from is Gene Pulaski did a synthesis of all of Bonneville's work in from 2005 back. A lot of the data that's included in the packet is historical data all the way back to why we put the ties in. Some of the information that was gleaned in some of our initial testing units, 17 for FGE, but then a lot of the stuff that we did once we brought the corner collector online, why we took out the ties from 11 to 14, what were we seeing, you know, originally when it comes to this, the concept of FGE improvements in between ties. So anyway, I thought it's very important to have Gene Pulaski on the phone because Gene has a very good handle about the historical data of why we put ties in, why we pulled them out at the south end, why we kind of continued to keep them in the north end, some of the hydraulics information. But I think what we wanted to do is I wanted to have this information in front of you to show where we've come, how they're performing now when it comes to overall passage at Bonneville, how they're contributing. And then I think the ultimate goal today was to make a decision or come to some form of resolution on what we're going to do in out years for performance testing.
We'll build new stainless steel ones, right?
Well, so...
that's our regulator.
Yeah.
Cardboard. Recyclable. Let them break down.
So right now, the old ones are sitting out. We have, what, five that we've been putting, six we put in this year. I think we also need to get our hands around. There is going to be some form of O&M and follow-on to these systems. I think the ties were designed originally, were prototype. These weren't, you know, permanent structures, and we've been using them as a permanent structure.
Unlike the core.
Yeah.
What's the John Day?
So I think there's also the discussion needs to happen. Is, and it doesn't need to happen until somebody says, yes, these are a good thing, and we need to move forward and keep them there.
So you just said there's six ties in this year?
There were six ties in this year.
Yeah. There's six left. How were they placed?
They 15 through unit 15 through 18 every other slot.
Every other slot.
Because there's three slots per unit.
Right. Yeah. Right.
So they started at 15B. Is that correct?
Yeah, but they're wider.
There's
than
two
a slot.
In odd numbers and one in even numbers.
They're not wider than a slot.
So 15A.
No. No. There's a gap. There's an intake gap in between each one of them. The width of an intake.
50 feet or something like that.
Yeah. So it's every other slot starting at 15B.
That's the key point. Because
excuse me, 15A.
Historically, we've seen that that's where the fish go, is between the ties themselves.
Right.
Kind of a vortex phenomenon that
it's sucking them down.
I don't know if it really sucks them down, but it certainly encourages them to go through those slots in between. And
In between and keeps them surface oriented, so they're,
which has nothing to do with the original intent.
No,
we intended the. You know,
no, it's a byproduct.
It is.
It was a byproduct,
and the intent was to mimic the shape of the intakes of most of the other dams in the system, which had, you know, Bonneville 2 being kind of a value engineered product, has a chopped off. Foredeck, and the other dams tend to have more of a sloping intake. So the idea was to create more of a sloping intake. This is some of the early modeling work that was done in the 80s. And, you know, sort of mimic, we're getting better guidance efficiency than we were at Bonnie 2. It worked. It's not exactly what we, you know, sort of serendipitous, but it worked, but not very, you know, it wasn't a huge benefit. So we were talking just a few percent maybe in guidance efficiency improvements. Mm-hmm. And since we put in the corner collector, that's taken away all the improvement, all the benefits
all
of these
benefits.
Things for the south side of the powerhouse, south half of the powerhouse. Plus, we never found an improvement for sub-yearling fish, which is the poorest guidance of all. So where we really needed the improvement, we didn't get it. So we tend, you know, we take them out in the summer. They're only in during the spring.
See, that's not the case anymore. We left them in.
It's because you couldn't get them out.
Well, that's,
couldn't
get that's them a out. Different issue. That's
yeah,
not,
but I mean, it, that, the concept was leave them in spring, they lose their efficiency in summer.
You pull them out.
Pull
that
them out.
That was the idea. Somewhere in right. June, you get rid of them as soon as you can. But it wasn't, you didn't have to. They were. It wasn't a negative for subs. It just didn't help subs. And
right.
So that was the key there. You could leave them as long as you wanted to soak on them. But,
right.
You know, I mean, I don't want to steal your thunder, Dennis, but
no,
our perspective on
no
this
thunder.
Thing,
there's no thunder.
It is, it's really up to the Corps of Engineers. If you feel you can make your performance standards without the ties in place, then certainly get rid of them because they're, I know, a maintenance nightmare.
And they're just trying to get in and out.
There's a due date on the, you know, on the mm-hmm. maintenance on them. And I always worry that somebody's going to get killed
yeah,
in the process
dangerous.
Of moving those things around. That just scares the heck out of me.
I mean, wind issues, you know, associated yeah. with it. I think Mike and I had a discussion this morning before the meeting and kind of reviewing this data. And kind of a take-home message from us is that in looking at, and I'm kind of referring to this passage revival considerations page, which is about the fourth page back, all the benefits, and so there's negligible benefits we can attribute to the ties. We do feel that we can achieve those performance measures without the ties in. And if you're saying core, if you think you can do that, Mike and I discussed this as yes, core. At least we think that we can get those without it, and we'd like to say we are going to do our testing without them in.
So your recommendation is to pull the ties, put them away at least for the near term, put them on the bank and leave them there.
We're going to put them on the bank, do our performance testing, and say, hey, did we achieve it? If we have to come back and we say we're borderline, at that point we need to start saying, okay,
what's the mix of things?
Well,
we
yeah,
do?
What's
they would be in the mix? Maybe not. Yeah, that's common.
Yeah.
Okay.
Can you walk through this table here, or
yes.
do the whole thing, whatever you want to do here? Because I just need to be confident that the subyearling impacts
sure.
are minimal.
Hey, Gene.
And did any
minimal.
Of this
There's
data?
No
yeah.
Gene, you on the phone there?
But did any of this data cover? When was it taken? Just in April long?
Did he say yet?
The fish guidance data.
Gene was on at 9 o'clock.
What year? We started this working.
Oh, I'm here.
Oh, he's here. Okay.
No, but I'm talking about what?
Hey,
month.
Gene, can you
the whole year? Whole year
for the whole season.
Dave Wills has some questions about, and I think it, this is a real good time to, since I asked you to be on the line.
All right, so Plosky's going to talk here, so I'll let
you. Can
you
kind of just walk through? Dave Wills wants to talk a little bit about specifics about the FG considerations and just kind of go through. Can you directly go through the four, first I printed out the handouts from stuff you sent. Can you just go through those and walk us through those? And then once we get to the survival page, I think that's where, you know, we're saying we can meet performance measures without it, without ties.
Sure.
Okay.
If you look at that first page, the first sentence needs a few corrections. I got to this around 7 o'clock last night.
I made the corrections for you, Gene.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, I put higher at intakes between ties than at intakes that have ties.
Oh, bless your heart.
Thank you. All right.
That was an embarrassment.
Oh, no problem.
Okay. Well, the gist of it is we didn't have any ties installed in 2008 or 2009 because the tie frame was broken. They couldn't get them. The plot there shows a black line that for 2010, where we had ties installed from unit 15 through 18, but they were out from unit 11 through 14. If you look at the x-axis, what I did was I've got a turbine unit number and then an underscore and then the number of intakes that are between ties. So I think I have that correct, that 15 would have one intake between ties,
yep.
And 17 also, but 16 and 18 would have two intakes between ties. So
historically, we know that there seems to be about a 10% benefit or increase in FGE between ties, and we've seen that with FICNET data. We've also seen it with hydroacoustic samples. Doesn't seem to be a benefit for intakes behind ties, but between ties, you get huge vortices formed. And those vortices take a lot of fish, I think, and they take them along the ceiling of the intake. And I've always thought that that was why you get an FGE bump between for intakes between ties.
And Gene, this Dave, is that because of the ties on either side creating that vortice?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
I believe so.
Okay. So you've been standing up there on the deck, and you see the two ties, and there's always that big vortice with debris and everything usually in between each tie.
Okay.
Yeah, those vortices, you can watch, we see the tails of those on the uplooking hydroacoustic beam, and occasionally that the tail of where it chokes down like a tornado at the base, those run real right along the ceiling of the intake. So if they're in training fish, they're more likely to be guided than unguided. But anyway, so if that's true, and we believe that to be true from all the empirical evidence that we have, then one would expect on that black line, the two circled points would be higher than other points on this whole graph. Because there are two intakes between ties at those two units, 16 and 18. And so when the ties were in, that seems to support, since we seem to be seeing a bump in FGE at those two units. The other ones where we have just one intake between ties, that's 15 and 17, it would be difficult to say that those were, there was much improvement in FGE there. So for Chinook, there seems to be further supporting evidence that there's a benefit to between ties anyway. For steelhead, these FGEs are calculated based upon acoustically tagged fish that were tracked going into these intakes. But for steelhead, I've circled the two points where we might expect to see a benefit, and we don't. I have to say that the number of fish used to calculate FGE is pretty low on the north side of the north end of the powerhouse. Because most, if you flip to the next page, most fish passage in the spring, most fish tend to pass through the southern unit. It's some historical radio telemetry and hydroacoustic data shown on the second page. And in the spring, you can see that it's definitely lower on the north end than it is on the south end. And these data were compiled, I think, before the B2 point collector was operational.
Yep.
You also see, at least with the hydroacoustic, that it tends to be higher on the south end in the summer. But the summer, we don't have ties installed usually anyway. The point of this, and then the next page as well, is just that most of the fish are not passing on the north end of the powerhouse. After the corner collector, if you look at the third page, after the corner collector was in place, most fish are obviously passing through the corner collector. There are also 10 usually higher numbers at the southern unit than at the northern unit.
So were there ties in place in 2004 and 2005?
Yes.
Okay. So I thought part...
They were in place. That was
But only half. But only half.
Yeah, the north half.
The north half.
I believe the tie crane was operational and they were in play.
Yes.
So I thought one of the benefits of the ties was also to break up that eddy that takes everything over the north side. So
that's right, but actually it was to break up the lateral flow across the entire powerhouse.
Okay.
And when you had ties from unit 11 to 18, it certainly did a lot to break up lateral flow. You just didn't see it. So I believe there would have been ties at every unit in 2004 and 2005.
Okay, in 2008 and 9, data that we're just looking at had no ties at all.
That's right, no
yeah.
ties at all.
Okay.
If you look at the, this is the fourth, maybe the fourth page, there's some, there's a lateral distribution plot from the acoustic telemetry tracked fish.
Keep going, gentlemen.
It was 2010 and 2009. And 2010 would have had, it shows Chinook in the upper graph and Steelhead in the lower graph. And in 2010, we had ties installed on the 15 through 18 in the spring.
Okay, yeah.
Again, unit 11 was off in both of these cases, but again, there's a tendency to more fish are passing 13 and 14 than are passing 15 through 18.
Okay.
On a per unit basis.
All right.
And I talked to Derek because he spent some time out at B2 this last year when the tides were in, and he says, and this should we should be able to check this with the CFD, but he tells me that surface flow patterns are very different when the tides are not installed at 15 through 18. That when they're installed. So he watched in 2008, 2009. He thought that the dividing point between, as flow comes into the powerhouse, it splits. And the water near the surface tends to go north and south to form the eddy. The dividing point, he said, between north and south flow was closer to 15 or 16 when there were no tides. In other words, flow headed south toward the corner collector was more like unit 15 or even 16 than it was. But when the ties were in place in 2010, that dividing point was closer to 14. So the ties were doing what they were designed to do, which was break up
that lateral flow.
What Derek is indicating is he thinks there may be some benefit in not having to tie at least 15 and 16 so that, you know, you get as much flow as possible heading south along the powerhouse.
Okay.
Again, that we should be able to look at a CFD model and see that.
Gene, I'd like to tax your memory here and go way back to 2004 when you were doing the evaluation of the Spring Creek release in March.
Yes.
You were doing hydroacoustic, and I don't remember if you had all the turbines wired up. I think you did, but I could be mistaken. Was there a pattern on where they passed? Any preference north or south?
No, the 2000, if I remember correctly, and I don't have the data in front of me, but we've almost always seen a tendency for passage to be higher at the south end of the powerhouse.
Okay.
Especially the corner collector operating.
I don't know if that's true for Spring Creek, though.
Well, that's what I wanted to double check. Now, we don't have a March release anymore. It's April.
Right.
So if...
So what's your point?
Well, I'm just trying to make sure... Ryan, to make sure I understand all the data that's available.
Waste our time.
No, say Spring Creek.
Because you can't differentiate Spring Creek fish in April from other fish in April.
It attacks everybody's memory. I'll go back to the 1980s when we originally did the work on ties. The improvements that we found were as a result not only of the ties, but of streamlined trash racks and raised operating gate. So we did three things at once.
Okay.
And the benefit we got was, and then it, like Gene said, 5 to 10%. We didn't know why. It was one, you know, those three things were done at the same time. So maybe the ties 100% of it, but probably not. I think that the streamlined trash racks and the raised operating gates, which let more flow into the unit through the VBSs, not the unit, but the VBSs, helped.
And in fact, that's what we, you know, with the FGE program, that was the whole point of that, was to get more flow of slots. So it was actually to enlarge the FGE, or the VBS.
How to get more flow of
slots? To get more flow of slots.
Yeah, more than we need right now, don't we?
What?
Yes.
Yeah.
Now too much.
Beyond the point.
Yeah.
So I, you know, I still see a little benefit of these things being in there now at this point.
Yeah.
In and of themselves, because we've done so much else. I mean, what the FGE program, which maybe was too successful, but it certainly was probably a bigger impact to FGE than the ties and all the other stuff combined.
Okay.
So if we were to make a recommendation to leave them out, we wouldn't get rid of them.
Mm-hmm. Not until you do the performance testing and find out if you need them or not.
Yeah,
but we also would maintain them.
That would be the gamble. You guys could not maintain them and think you're not going to need them, and then hope to God you don't have to re-maintain them, because if you do have to maintain them, you're going to have to do a lot more.
Well, the question is, would you do O&M on these ties, or would you actually make a new type of tie? Is there a better tie in the world?
Putting them out there, I don't worry about that. You're never going to end up going down that road in the future, I don't think.
I think that's a gamble. That'd be a safe gamble. For
yeah, I wouldn't worry too much about it, but I would worry about if you're going to, and you're going to leave them out there as an option in case we miss standards. What do you do with them? You know, do you just set them on the riverbank and let them rust, or do you shrink wrap them, or you know, do something to keep them from continuing to degrade while they're sitting there? For the next 2 years, because this will be probably a two-year performance test, or maybe three if the year gets really weird, you know, out there. So,
well, if you guys are thinking about putting them back in, we'd probably shrink wrap them or something like that.
That's what I would think. You could do something like that. But when you do that,
I'm not going to be able to scrape any money together to do some serious maintenance on them.
Yeah, I would.
Except for shrink wrapping them.
Do whatever you can do, minimum.
Or just make them disappear.
Why not just leave them? I mean, why even shrink wrap them?
Yeah, they just need to sit
there.
You'd have to get a green shrink wrap or the brown, depending on the gorge color.
Right.
Because they're in pretty bad shape.
No, they are.
First they need to be evaluated.
Takes some time.
I mean, you know, they need to go out there and say, can they sit there for 3 years? And then if there is a plan to put them back in, what would it cost to rehab them enough?
These days I'll go out there for an inspection, and it's like,
you know,
where'd they go?
Yeah, I think part of it is the side mesh. You know, the steel structure and the steel plates around the face. I think that's
sure.
Good. It's that side mesh stuff that seems to be eaten up.
Did you have a cost estimate on repairing the side mesh?
What I would probably do is just let them sit there
and then recognize that if we do have to put them back in, there's going to be some cost.
If we go 2 years of performance testing, and it's looking, you know,
dismal,
or we're not meeting, I think, you know, we need to start thinking about, okay, well, if we don't meet it the third year, somebody's going to be asking us to maybe reconsider ties again.
So for O&M, you're looking at how many years in your budget.
That might become a CRFM, actually.
Exactly.
Oh, that's true.
Because you're speaking of a new program to design a new
improved.
What you do is you just go a new improved tie, which becomes a CRFM program. It's out of O&M. You're done.
Right.
There you go.
Are you done? Can we move on?
Let's go. Okay, sounds like a plan.
There you go.
So do we want to, are they going to sit there for 3 years?
Yes.
Or okay, and then after that, it'll either be mothballed or redesigned.
Scrap.
The scrap prices are high.
Well,
yeah. Wait for your best steel price and then recycle.
Will they sit there 3 years or will they work through that?
The steel probably will.
They're not going anywhere.
Well, if
that's what that
whole for some reason you do have to do a modification improvement, you're going to have to anyway because of the condition of them. Maybe not, but.
Up to you guys. Whatever you want to do.
All right, so we.
We just drive on.
Well, it's just like the BGS. We wouldn't pull the BGS out and reinstall the same BGS because it doesn't meet our performance objectives for longevity.
Right.
We would never put these. We wouldn't probably rehab these and get longevity that we want. So I don't think it makes sense to even sit them there.
No,
really up to you guys.
But that's
you guys can hash inside what your best economic option is and go with.
All right, scrap.
Before we leave this, though,
yes.
Could you please explain the table?
Yes. Gene, there's the passive survival considerations page for what we got for 2008, 2009, 2010. Can you go through those numbers?
Yeah, sure. These are the acoustic telemetry passive survival estimates. From the columns up from left to right are at the second powerhouse as a whole, through the B2 corner collectors, the CC, through the JBS, through B2 turbine, and then the dam as a whole on the right. There's a mix of things in here. Some of the numbers are relative estimates, either relative to the B2 corner collector, and some of them are single release passage estimates. But I think more important than the absolute numbers are just the trends. And I've highlighted in red, I don't know whether you probably can't see that. But
no, they're in red.
JBS and B2 turbine. You'll see that the B2 turbine survivals that were obtained in 2008 and 2009 are pretty high. They're like 97% for 98% for yearland Chinook. And for juvenile steelhead, they're like 98-95%. In 2009, those were single release estimates. So if we had a reference release, the paired release estimate would have been above that. Even if you look at dam survival as a whole, all the way over on the right hand side, and I only had dam survival for 2010 so far. The single release estimates in 2010, the yearling Chinook, they would have met the criteria with a single release estimate, and they were pretty close for juvenile steelhead to the dam as a whole. So that's a single, those are single release. So I don't know. When you ties out from units 15 through 18, if you want to evaluate that, I think FGE is a consideration. I think the historical information about between ties, behind ties, is pretty compelling. But on a whole unit, turbine unit intake, or a whole turbine unit basis, the bump is, just not 10% for the whole turbine. And then if you look at horizontal distribution of passage, more fish tend to pass south end of the powerhouse than the north, but feel confident in saying that. And if you look at the survival to determine are, they're not as good as the JBS in most cases, but we're not talking about a lot of difference. We're talking about that. So,
put it back
in the file again. It's up for others to make the decision, but those are all the things I would say.
Right.
Okay, thanks.
Any other questions? All right. All right, so it is the Corps' decision based on the subtask group recommendation.
Our recommendation is the Corps can make a decision.
Can make a decision.
This goes back to that POM can consider it in the next meeting.
So I put it as an agenda item for the next FPOM group?
Yeah.
The subgroup,
which is basically you're looking at.
Yeah, the subgroup technical recommendation or technical evaluation is that there's no benefit.
No benefit, and that they could be removed.
It's the Corps' decision to remove them. If they want to take them off-site or on-site, it's their decision. As long as they are meeting their performance standards,
just make sure that your recommendation comes at FPOM.
Right. The task group is saying that.
No. It's on the agenda already.
We know where you're going to be. It's just football. Good.
It's cool. Next.
That was easy.
All right. So anybody needed to use the bathroom before we get into the AFF?
Are we going to
here? Yeah.
Why don't we take a quick break?
Yeah.
Quick break.
Bye, Bruce.
Call the.
Thanks, Gene.
Appreciate it.
You guys are going on.